Musings Podcast with Fairbairn and Russell. Welcome to the Market Musings Podcast, where today we are joined by our guest Phil Thomas, who is the President and CEO of AIS Resources. And of course, Phil, we spoke on Stockbox. We had an interview just about a week or so ago, but we are very pleased to have you on the Market Musings Podcast, where we can have a more general and relaxed chat as if we were in the local pub, although it's too early for a drink where I am. I'm not sure what it's like with you, but you're very welcome anyway. How are you?
Very, very well. And Mark and Russell, thanks for having me on the podcast. I think this is a great medium to listen to what's going on and get the latest news.
Great. It's good to have you on. So, Kenny, how are you?
Yep, all good. There's a bit of blue sky here in Scotland, which is a bit unusual this time of the year. I'm delighted to see that. It's been pretty miserable the last couple of days. So I take it there's plenty of blue sky where you are, Phil. Make me jealous of the temperature.
In Melbourne, it's normally hot around February, March, because we kind of have a delayed summer sometimes. And we've got 13 to 17 degrees today. So, it's back to long pants again, but no doubt Monday, Tuesday will be hot again, but which is typical Melbourne weather, four seasons in one day. But fortunately, we didn't have the rain that Sydney got, and at Yalgogran in New South Wales, where our project is starting, I hear it's 27 degrees and nice and sunny. I saw some pictures today, so all good up there, not walking around in mud, which is great.
Yeah, I'm jealous already, because it's probably about 7 or 8 degrees here, and I think we've got snow forecast for Saturday. So yeah, It is what it is. But yeah, it's great to have you on, Phil. And what we like to do is, rather than just have the standard interviews, you know, the 20 questions that probably CEOs tend to get fed up with, we like to kind of sort of strip it back and find out a bit more about yourself, you know, what you've done in the past, you know, your business career, how you get into geology. You know, you can go back to your childhood, your school days, your education. You know, you can just give us a, you know, maybe a 15 minute overview of, you know, how your journey to AIS Resources. And the floor is yours, just to give us a bit of background about you.
Yeah. Well, I've never really stood back from a challenge. And and I also have a fond understanding of how people work. And so after I graduated, I finished high school, I got a number of scholarships at various universities and a graduate scholarship to BHP in their metallurgy area, because I studied industrial arts at high school. But of course, I made the absolute correct decision. I went to the university closest to my girlfriend. So I went to Australian National University, who have probably a more theoretical course than a practical course like Ballarat or Curtin University in Western Australia. So because I was reasonable at maths, I actually did an applied maths degree, doing third year subjects in applied maths and also geology. And of course, the inevitable happened. Because I was trying to do a major in geology, I had to beef up the number of units to satisfy the prerequisites. And by 2.5 years, I'd finished my 3 year degree. So I thought, well, I'll do another year of geology, because gold is only offered in the alternative years, and that was for me another year's time. So I added another 10 points to my degree and finished all the gold units, the mineralogy, the isomorphology, and all the units around microscope geology, which was the thrust of it. But absolutely fortuitous, I had a chap called Dr. Bruce Chappell as my third and fourth year tutor in geology, and he wrote the Bible on S and I type granites and then became A type granites. And of course, at Yalgogran in New South Wales, Australia, where our project is, what do we have? S and I and A type granites. So I was blessed doing that course and taking the challenge to finish my gold units and also expand my knowledge of S&I and A-type granites and the orogenies that persisted. And of course, the Lachlan orogeny is where he did most of his work. And that's exactly where we're mining and exploring at the moment with our current drill program. So, and I actually was looking through some old documents the other day and I couldn't believe it. In fourth year, I wrote a assignment on where to drill in the Fosterville area. And I had this carefully mapped out paper on where the drill hole locations could be. And I was a little bit out, but I wasn't far from Fosterville. So I was quite surprised that I'd actually figured it out as a very, very green, almost puce-coloured student without having any real practical experience. So I guess I learned something from that degree. Then the Poseidon crash came through, nickel prices fell out of bed, and most geologists fell out of bed. So I was looking for a job, and I'd had a keen interest in geophysics, blending my maths and geology background together, and I was fortunate enough to get a job at the Control Data Mining Service Centre. And Control Data was significant because they had a massive 64K cyber computer with a 64K bit data path, which in those days was kind of like the Rolls-Royce of computers. And the Commonwealth Scientific Industrial Organisation Australia had one. And so, you know, to get access to that, and we had these massive 1,200 megabyte dishwashers, and there was just a sea of them. We used to load the software up on tapes, and we had round screens, not square screens, and we would get our modem and connect and our keyboard and run the programs on that. So I got an enormous amount of experience in 2 years. I worked on a range of gold, uranium, copper projects, doing all sorts of things from producing synthetic seismograms for oil companies to look at the sections that they were looking to drill, through to producing optimized block extraction for Olympic Dam and Western Mining's other operations, to working out drill hole patterns. So I got a really kind of practical experience very quickly in the two-year period, working with lots of companies, which is ideal for a geologist because you want to look at as many scenarios as you can and have some really good guys sitting around you to work. So I did that for 2 years, and then I got tapped on the shoulder and a chat from a bank called Hill Samuel in the UK said, look, would you like to join us, because you obviously have fairly sophisticated nonlinear mathematics skills, and join our portfolio company, join our company and help run the portfolio management system. So I had no idea what he was talking about, but I joined, and that became Macquarie Bank, and I basically set up the institutional funds management business for Macquarie Bank in fixed interest, and then lent my experience at raising capital and other bits and pieces. And then I thought, hang on, I can't just be a scientist. I need to have some business skills. So I went off and did an MBA and specialised in marketing, but I gave it a twist with decision support analysis. So I spent a lot of time on option theory and applying detailed option theory to decision-making within a marketing context. What I didn't realise was that all that work I put in my master's degree, I used to become a certified mineral valuer in Australia. So now I'm a director of the Australian Institute of Mineral Valuers and Appraisers, and written some papers and done some fairly exciting work on very, very large, I'm talking billion-dollar mineral valuation projects. Once I'd worked for Macquarie Bank and had 6 years of funds management experience, because I had the Macquarie Bank tag on my resume, I started moving around into more senior roles and joined McIntosh Securities as an executive director, looking after all their retail operations, warrants, futures, options, gold trading, etc. So I rounded out and was involved in raising the capital at the retail level float. So I got a pretty good understanding of how to float a company. Mm-hmm. Then I left in 1990, which was a watershed year in Australia, in that superannuation became a major place where people were putting funds, and it was starting to increase faster than the traditional fund managers. So overall, I decided that because I was in a broking environment, which was becoming more and more internet driven and fees were dropping, there really wasn't a future in that strategy. So I moved out and joined Watson Wyatt, which was a group of consulting actuaries, and once again, with my mathematics skills, learned how to add up and look at a superannuation fund, how to value assets and liabilities long term, which then again helped me with my mineral valuation experience. I spent 7 years there and did some work for all the majors, BHP, looking at investment problems and obviously marketing their various consulting actuarial services. And I guess the highlight of that 7 year period was winning the actuarial, being part of the team that won the actuarial appointment to BHP, which had been held by Mercer's for about 15 years. And we knocked them off their block and got that appointment. And that was partly due to the expertise and the experience of the guys in the office. I played just a minor role in the sales and marketing, but they really knew their stuff in terms of how to optimize or how to maximize results for companies with big defined benefit funds, which is part and parcel of where we find most of our investment funds today in superannuation funds. From there, I went out and became CEO after I wrote a very long paper for a company called Admiralty Resources. And I picked up my hammer and microscope and eyeglass and magnifying glass and got back into it again and became, from risk manager, became CEO and then CEO and chairman and raised some money. And we had four projects. We had actually five projects. We had some tantalum feldspar in Africa. We had a polymetallic deposit in Argentina that no one knew, but it was owned by Argentina Diamonds. So I assumed it was a diamond kimberlite deposit. Mm-hmm. I'll come back to that in a minute. And then we had another deposit, which was a laterite nickel cobalt deposit. And then lastly was a silver lead zinc deposit in Bulman in the Northern Territory, which we thought was connected to the MacArthur River CRA deposit in those days. So I cut my teeth on thorium, potassium, strontium mapping, satellite mapping, and I found this massive deposit of galena. And so it was the size of a riverbed, probably 5 meters wide by 4 meters long. And I thought, hello, I found the holy grail. This is going to put a major mark on my career as the find the biggest galena deposit in the world. So I consulted with all my colleagues and we did a drill program. We mapped it. We did some geophysics. We got the fault system and we put our first couple of drill holes down and we got nothing. And then I quickly realized that there's more to exploration than just doing the groundwork. You've got to have a sixth sense. I think that sixth sense is missing from some geologists, and other geologists have got it. And so interpreting the data isn't all scientific. So we had a iron ore deposit, which was the fourth project. So basically over the next 6 years at Admiralty Resources, I explored, put a iron ore deposit into production, and we produced nearly a million tonnes over 2 years and shipped it out to China. We produced a lithium deposit in the Rincon, and the Rincon Salar was good to us because all the lithium was in the surface, which is different to the models that are currently projected by some of the so-called experts working for the Canadian Institute of Metallurgy and Mining. So that was highly successful. We produced about 4,000 tonnes of lithium carbonate and sold that. And then the GFC hit and we had to sell an asset. It was going to take ages to sell the iron ore project. So I sold the lithium project to the current owners of Rincon Lithium. And we made good money on that. We retired all our debt. And because I was really interested in lithium and not in iron ore that much, I decided to leave the company and do my own thing. Mm-hmm. So then I went to Argentina, set up the lithium project in Pozuelos, and basically explored that and came up with a resource and raised $60 million with that project. And then on-sold it, and, of course, LSC Lithium bought it for $300 million further down the track, and then sold it again recently for $85 million. So shows you the fortunes of lithium. And I had quite a bit of success just doing things for myself. And then in 2016, Martin Element rang me up and said, hey, are you still with Admiralty? I said, no, I left ages ago and I've done my own thing and, you know, things are going pretty well. And he said, do you want to be a chief operating officer or consultant? I said, I'll be the consultant. I'm not sure whether I'm ready for public life again, public company life again. So I joined and explored the Washitok Salar. But I'd been exploring the 26 lithium salars in Argentina. So I knew all of them. I knew their chemistry. I knew their geophysics. I knew a lot about how to extract lithium because of my experience at the Rincon. Mm-hmm. Then prior to that, I'd worked on, I was CEO from 2012 to 2016. I was CEO of Arrowstar Resources, another Canadian listed company. And we did quite a bit of work there. And between 2008 and 2012, I worked on the Julian Gold Project in California. That was a pretty interesting project from a geology point of view. I also worked on the Tin Cup mine in Arizona with Arrowstar Resources. That was a gold project. I worked on the Aztec mine, which is near Nazca in Peru, and that was a volcanic porphyry-style deposit. So I got possibly five or six major gold projects. So my knowledge of gold exploration and epithermal and hydrothermal and mesothermal projects went through the roof because I was actually got the hammer out and I was actually walking around getting it done and directing the traffic in the Nazca mine by going down the shaft and helping the guys with the mine engineer. So at the end of the day, I focused on Washitok with AIS Resources as the first project. Unfortunately, we weren't able to get onto the land from the native title in Jujuy. And interestingly, Jujuy is done by administration, whereas Salta and Catamarca are judicial. And we've always had great success. Rincon was in Salta province, whereas the Jujuy province, I think, is destined to be a backwater until they change the attitude. We did everything possible. We had meetings. We had notaries there. We did everything possible, but we just couldn't convince the people because they were being lobbied very heavily from Buenos Aires, and there's not a lot you can do when, you know, everyone's writing checks and they're going to the highest bidder in some cases. In other cases, they're being pushed very, very hard. So the first sort of 3 or 4 years with AIS Resources was running that. Then I went to Peru and got an opportunity to sell some manganese and open up some manganese mines, but unfortunately the price dropped and hasn't recovered the same way as the iron ore price has gone up. So we abandoned, we haven't abandoned, we've put that on care and maintenance at the moment, waiting for the price to recover. And I said to the board, look, why don't we go and start looking for gold and exploring gold in Australia because it's in my backyard. I can't travel due to COVID, and off we went. So I very quickly bought the fabulous project in Fosterville, which is Fosterville Tulene, which is exactly 10 kilometres from the back of the Robin mine at Fosterville, and sits between the Whitelaw and the Whitelaw Fault and the Mount Williams Faults. And it's in the Lachlan Origin, which goes all the way up to our New South Wales project, which is in the eastern Lachlan Origin up there, at Yale Gogren. So then I quickly realised that a chap who hadn't had a lot of support had this fantastic project in the Granites, and going back to my days with Bruce Chappell, and I knew a lot about it. So we did a deal, and for $400,000 we got 60% of that project, and we're currently drilling that at the moment, as I mentioned. And then I noticed that BHP and Western Mining had done a lot of work, and then Navarre had it, and then Range Resources had a project called Kingston, which was 167 square kilometres. We did a deal there. It's particularly attractive because of the way the geology is very simple. There's reefs everywhere, quartz all over the place, although that's not necessarily a good sign. And so I used my geology experience there to negotiate a good deal for $500,000, and we get 15% of the mine revenue that's being started there. So that was good. And then recently we just pegged 596 square kilometres, which is a big area, and we've just been exploring for gold in Robinson's Creek in the last couple of weeks. We haven't been that successful in finding the Holy Grail, but we've got some interesting data from our last lot of exploration, but we've only looked at probably half a square kilometre of the 596. So we're doing a lot of desktop research and poring over the satellite data at the moment to try and pick some targets. So that's kind of been the career in a snapshot, with some of the highs and some of the lows of being in the exploration game.
Great.
Yeah, well, it's quite interesting, Phil, because most of the CEOs we have on, usually they start off at ground level. You know, as you say, they've got their hammer out and they sort of serve their apprenticeship, you know, working their way up through the structure and then get to board level. But you seem to have done it the other way about. You quickly, you know, you get into these funds and you got yourself up to an executive director role. But obviously,
yeah, well,
your heart was in the, you know, the coal face, and you've been dragged back down to the coal face, and you sound as if you actually enjoy that a lot more than the politics of the boardroom.
Yeah, well, it's very rare to find a CEO that has a actuarial level investment banking background, and also understanding how a gradient array and dipole works from a mathematics point of view. And I was just talking to our geophysicist the other day, and I said, "What sort of optimizer are you using for?" The S1, S2, and P1 waves in the gradient array. And he said, "What are you talking about, Phil?" I said, "You know, the matrix calculation to optimize between the two waves." And he said, "Mate, you're talking rocket science to me." And I just thought, well, you know, that was second year geophysics. You know, and he did know. He said, "You know, here's the software, have a look at it." So it's good to be able to dig in when you need to, but you know, there's other stuff like the SERPAC software. I could run it if they gave me a month, but there are other guys that live and breathe it every day, all day, and you just hand the data to them and say, run the mine model or run the exploration model on this data, will you? Because you don't want to be trying to run software and other bits and pieces for part of the job. So part of the skill of being a CEO, I think, is to know when to dive in, when not to dive in, and when to delegate to get maximum leverage and speed. And, you know, that's what most people have been quite amazed at, how fast we can do things. For example, we ended up doing a joint venture with MGX, which is another Canadian listed company, on a project called Salinas Grandes in August. And we'd finished the geophysics, the trenching, the drilling by December. So, you know, it took basically 4 months to go from where to go to decide that the project wasn't big enough to spend any more money on it. So, you know, if and that's because I had a good understanding of the technical processes and able to raise enough capital. We did a $4 million capital raising in those days, and the NGX contributed some money as well. So I think that's the key. And if you have a look at all the guys that are successful, you know, Navarre, Stahl, et cetera, they've all got technical backgrounds, but they've also got you know, a bit of time in a Macquarie Bank or a you know, Nikko Securities or one of the other big mining shops.
Mm. Yeah, Yeah, I think it was key as well. I mean, coming to AIS resources now, all your projects are drill ready, and obviously you mentioned that. I think just today, actually, you started drilling at Yalgogren.
Yeah, that's right. Yalgogren's up near West Wylong, which is not too far. It's about 60K or maybe 90K from Forbes, which is the nearest big town. And it was unusual because Dennis Walsh, our chief geologist, who spent a couple of years at Fosterville, Kirkland Lake, and a couple of years with some other major explorers, but he'd spent 20 years looking at this deposit. And Thompson Resources has pegged all around us, and I think they call Thompson Resources because one of the Thompson faults runs not far away from where we are. But notwithstanding that, the project was drill ready because they Dennis had done a superb job in the geology, and you know, I've got to take my hat off to him. I couldn't find fault with anything that he'd done. It was pretty spectacular the way he'd arranged the data, and he had all the drill core and chips and stuff from drilling he's done. But you know, to be able to draw the isobars for the gold, to be able to do that amount of augering and to have the RC drilling and rock chips and everything available and having really good assays, QA, QC couldn't be faulted. It was just a walk-up start. I mean, you know, that would have cost us probably in the vicinity of $1 million today to produce what we bought for $400,000 and his ears. So,
yeah.
It was very drill ready from the sense that the exploration data, the only thing that he was missing was the IP survey, and we did a gradient array, which really just looks at the surface plan. And then we did a dipole array, which looks at the elevation. So when you put the elevation and the plan together, you get some pretty interesting sections so you can actually see what's going on, albeit you're looking at milliseconds per volt. So you're not looking at rocks, but you're looking at electrical conductivity, which showed where the gold, and you know, we got fantastic, or Dennis got terrific results, 32 grams per ton, half a meter from the surface, over half a meter, 12 grams per ton, 24 grams per ton, 2.9 grams per ton over 7 meters. So, you know, some of the results were outstanding, if not exceptional, and that's the sort of stuff you want. You know, I look at people that are getting 1.9 and 2 grams over 20 metres, and I feel sorry for them because the cost of producing gold from 2 grams per tonne is, you know, 10 times more than if you've got 20 grams per tonne. So it's better to have some concentration, albeit and the other thing was it was less than 25 metres from the surface, the oxide zone, and then we don't know what's in the sulphide zone because he never drilled deeper. So that's the task for the next couple of weeks, is to put 10 holes down at 100 metres, and that'll break through the sulphide zone, and that'll give us a good indication. If it's still open, we'll go back and drill it. And Tulin is, we finished the deep ground penetrating radar. We've found a lot of paleo channels which we could drill and do alluvial mining or placer mining, but we don't want to do that. We want to go for hard rock. We want to find the reefs and the tension faults. So while it's not as drilling ready as Yalgogren is, it's still got a lot of very attractive data from the surface. And in fact, I was just downloading today the aeromagnetics that have been done at 100 metre interval by the Geoscience Australia, which is absolutely, it's free, so absolutely fantastic start. And we'll do closely spaced gravity so we can get the structure, and then we'll be ready to drill. So we're not far away from being drill ready. And Kingston, it's got so many shafts, I don't know, I know where to start, but you know, it's almost like, you know, which lollipop do you pick? So we've got some good ideas. We've done some rock chip sampling, but we'll basically go through the tried and proven process. We'll do some soil sampling. We'll run some IP geophysics. And then we'll get the drill out and hit it. And it's interesting in that it's in Crown Land area, which is going to have a mine literally 2 kilometres away from where we're going to target. So the precedent to open a mine is already set, which is great. Not easy, but great. But there are other areas which are private property, which basically got nothing on them, which we can use to explore. And once again, quartz everywhere, just incredible. And it's a big area, 167 square kilometres. Yeah. You only need 5 square kilometres to run a mine, which is basically what the fossil area is on. So that's pretty exciting. And Cassidy, if we find anything, then we spend 50 grand. If we don't find anything, we spend 50 grand. If we find something, fantastic. And we know where the nickel is, we know where the copper is. So, you know, 3 out of our 4 properties are, as you say, drill ready. A little bit more work to do in a couple of them, but, you know, not far away.
Obviously, Phil, Victoria at the moment seems to be one of the hottest sort of goalpost codes in the world, you know, with everyday staking ground. I mean, there's pretty much nothing much left to take in Victoria. It's all been picked up. It seems to be the place to be if you want.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an explorer's gold rush. And, I mean, if you take it literally, the Department of Jobs, Precincts and Regions that runs Earth Resources in Australia, in Victoria, came out and said, you know, there's 75 million ounces of gold still undiscovered. And they have some very, very clever guys working in the department. I mean, they do a lot of work. They do a lot of geophysics work, a lot of structural geology work, and they really sort of give us a regional overview of what's going on. But I just looked at the map the other day, and apart from probably 5 major areas which are under moratorium, and I'll talk about that in a minute, every fault and probably within 20 kilometres of every fault in Victoria has been covered by an exploration licence, and some people are taking 1,800 square kilometres. You know, it's $1, $150 per kilometre to have your licence cost. So some of these guys are getting in the hundreds of thousands of licence costs, which they have to pay over and above their exploration costs. So there is a lot of gold, and the gold forms in various formats. So, for example, Outback, who have just taken the Petrotherm properties to the south of Fosterville Tulene, they're in the Crosby Granites, which is a different type of geology to Fosterville, which is 35 kilometres north, which is the Ordovician turbidites and shales, which is different again, 200 kilometres to the west, which is where the intrusives are. So, you know, Victoria has a wide range of geology sitting around a major origin, and, you know, basically crustal plates and faulting has created and lots of hydrothermal fluids from all sorts of sources have created. And at Tulene, for example, we've got these Permian gravels, but they're full of gold. And we've one of our landowners has picked up 30 ounces of gold using his metal detector, just walking around the 2 or 3 square kilometres he's got of his farm. So, you know, there's all sorts of complications, and for the junior geologist, all sorts of traps to fall into when you're looking at stuff. But having said that, over the last 3 years, I've never seen so much money spent in Victoria on exploration, and you know, I've been looking at it for quite a while.
And what I've been gathering from Victoria is that there's a lot of what's been referred to as blind discoveries, and it's with the advent of modern mining technology that's enabling explorers today to find gold that's at depth that wasn't previously at the surface. And is that effectively what's happening there? And there's a heck of a lot more to discover.
Yeah, that's right. There's kind of a couple of themes. Generally, very, very broadly speaking, as you go to the north, your cover increases, and you get up to the Murray Basin, and it's, you know, a couple of hundred metres deep. Around the Mitiamo and around there, it's probably 100 metres deep. maybe a bit deeper. Mm. And then as you go over to the west towards Fosterville and then over to the Glenelg basin, it gets shallower and then gets deeper again. And there's some volcanics up there as well, which obviously are much shallower. So, but as I said, the Lachlan Fold Belt, it's called the Lachlan Fold Belt because it folds and has been heavily faulted and moves around all over the place. So the shallow cover material of Ballarat and Bendigo in some places is 800 metres deep, but on the surface it had a lot of surface expression. So you could basically walk along, have a look at a piece of laminated quartz and whammo, there's some gold. Put a shaft down to to 100 metres or 70 metres where typically the water table is, and you found gold. And they got out, you know, hundreds and or millions of ounces of gold. If you have a look at Fosterville, you know, they've extracted 2.6 million ounces of gold out of that. But the depth really didn't start until about 2 or 3 years ago when they changed their model and went down, and now they're down to 400 or 500 metres. And the same with Costerfield. Costerfield has got 3 kilometres of tunnels, probably going down to 500 metres or even deeper. Mm. But, you know, different geology, but maybe 100 kilometres apart. So the geology changes quite quickly in certain areas, but it's consistent in other areas. So that's been the problem. Yeah, and no one's going to drill 500 metres. In fact, Stall North Mines Exploration has got a big drill program on. I understand they've got 3 rigs running, and some of their holes are down to 500 metres to get through the basalts. But once they get through the basalts, underneath the basalts is a shale, which is full of gold. So, But once again, deep cover. As opposed to Tulene, the Ordovician basement's 26 metres down. So, yeah. It's the system, the vein systems are close to the surface there. So, you go from one to the other as you go through the Murray Basin.
Yeah, so it's almost like a box of chocolates, isn't it? You just don't know what's in the next layer. Well, I suppose you do with modern techniques, but, you know, I mean, there's so many, as you say, different types of geology and all sorts of... hydrothermal activity going on over the years. So, no, it's certainly interesting, and it sounds like AIS, you know, you're definitely right projects, right location, and it sounds like with what you've told us, you know, the right people in the business as well. So, no, I'm looking forward to having you back on again, Phil, because, you know, you've clearly had a great career, you know, starting off in the sort of business and board side of investment funds and banks, etc., and now you're back at obviously what you trained to do. So,
I think
great having you on
the career. Yeah, I was going to come on to that. It is a very rounded career, starting in geology, then in working with the big computers and looking at mine optimization. That must have been very interesting, and then investment banking, and then back to sort of geology and running these companies. So it's a fantastic, I think, background for what you're doing. And I liked when you said about having a sixth sense, and I wonder maybe if we can finish on that kind of note. What's your sixth sense? As Kenny says, you are in the right area, but do you have a sixth sense about, you know, what you might find?
Look, it's difficult. I know what I'm looking for, and I've got all the tools operating, but it's looking for consistency. Yeah, and if you've got consistency, then you're on the right track. And if you are looking for laminated quartz and you find big bunches of bulk quartz, then that can be discouraging. But if you can follow a structure, then you're on the track. And it's really while you can plot it, and you can plot isotherms and all sorts of stuff, at the end of the day, it's really just having a sense of saying, okay, I'm going to put the drill there, hole there, versus the drill hole over there. Mm. A good example of that was when I was looking at the VES geophysics in Washington, in Positos, when we drilled that. And I said, no, guys, we're going to put the hole right down here. and we got 110,000 litres a minute of brine squirting out of its own ground pressure. And it was just the fact that I looked at the surface expression and looked at the drill core as we were going to 200 metres. I thought, yep, we're on the money here.
Mm.
This looked quite promising. So was there any scientific basis? Probably not. I was really just looking for data and seeing the data that I was looking for, and that gave me a sixth sense of saying, yep, we're on the money.
Okay.
So it's hard to tell. I mean, part of it's luck as well. Maybe it's not a sixth sense. Maybe it's luck.
You took the words out of my mouth, Phil. Yeah. I was just about to say, you always need a bit of luck in life, no matter what you do.
I think so.
But you can make your own luck. You can do a lot of things look forward to having you back on, and it's interesting to be talking to a TSX company as well instead of the sort of usual UK companies that we're talking to. So it's good to get around the world, because obviously you're in Australia, I'm in Scotland, and Mark's in Holland. So it's great that technology can bring us all together now, and we can just have a chat as if we're sitting next to each other. It's a great medium to get the word out. But anyway, we appreciate your time today, Phil, and we'll look forward to speaking to you again. Mark,
thanks, Ken. Thanks, Mark.
Yeah, no, it's been great, Phil. Thank you very much. And as Kenny says, I'll echo that. I look forward to seeing the progress develop there. But thank you. It's been a great insight into your background and the company. And I think it's going to be certainly one to keep an eye on. So thank you very much for coming on, talking to us.
My pleasure.
That's great. Thanks, Phil.
Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Fairbairn and Russell. Tune in next time.